Let's have the discussion. You're listening to Canter with Scott and Adam.
Hello, welcome to Canter. I'm Scott Hillier, and joining me today is Dr. Stephen Chalk of Canterponics. Welcome to the show, Dr. Steve.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us, mate. It's a pleasure having you on. This is a face-to-face one, which is really cool. It's only the second time I've had the opportunity to do this. No, third time, sorry.
Yes.
But it's good, and we're familiar with each other, which is really cool.
Yeah, we go way back.
We do. Yeah, it's cool. Now, Dr. Steve, my guests potentially won't know who you are or what you're about. You've got an accent. Let's go back to the start, man. Tell us a bit about yourself and how you ended up here.
You want to go right back?
Yes.
Okay, Scott. Well, yeah, as you can tell, I'm from the UK, from the South Coast, near Bournemouth, which is quite nice this time of year. And I studied medicine at Oxford and then King's College London. And worked in the UK for a few years before seeing sense of moving over here, like most POMs to the north of Perth, and settled into the emergency department up there in the north of Perth. Enjoyed a couple of years working and training there before deciding to have a bit of a change and moving to GP training. So I did my GP training down in Albany, which is the south coast of WA, which is an exceptionally lovely place to go. And then moved back up here to Perth to, you know, settle into GP life with my family and enjoy the lifestyle.
That's really cool. What made you move here in the first place, mate? Were you traveling with people, or were you just looked at the map and thought that looks like a cool climate, or what's the story?
Yeah, all of my good buddies from medical school had the right idea and came over here, you know, immediately after finishing their training for a sort of working holiday. And I stayed back and stayed behind and tried to see it through in London. And I came over for a holiday and realized, you know, this is probably the place to be in terms of lifestyle and work-life balance and even support at work and a few other things. So I came over here just really as all my mates were leaving. But I settled in quickly and there was no going back. Almost immediately I just felt at home.
Did you come solo?
Yep.
And you met your wife here.
Yeah. So yeah, that's a whole different story, which is a good story, but I won't go into it on this one.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
All right, man. After we finish recording, I want to hear that story, man.
Yeah.
But that's really cool. So you met your wife here.
Yeah.
You fell in love and you ended up staying, settling. You're a full-fledged Aussie now, mate.
Yep.
You definitely don't fit into the whinging POM category, which is really cool.
Oh, that's good.
Very good, man.
My wife will say different, but yeah.
That's cool. Okay, so you came here, you did a bit of emergency work.
Yeah.
Why did you not stay with that?
It's a pretty tough gig there. Yep. In the
the hours
emergency or? Department. Yeah, it's the hours are, you know, the hours are difficult because it's shift work, you know, and you're only really working normal days sort of 30% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise you're working evenings, nights. And so I just found it really hard to, yep, kind of juggle that with a family life. It was high stress work, obviously, as well. And, I gave it a good go, and I enjoyed my time there, enjoyed my training there, and I learned a lot. And I don't regret it, but, I was really happy once I settled into GP work just to be able to spend more time with the family.
Yeah. I guess the routine would be appealing. I mean, as someone that's done FIFO in the past, I understand the issues with not being around at home with any sort of consistency and not being able to spend the time with the people you love.
That's right. And, you know, specialist doctors, they sacrifice a lot to get, mm-hmm, get where they are.
Yeah.
And they work very hard. So, but I'm very happy doing GP work and having gone through GP training. It's a really interesting and really rewarding line of work.
Yeah, I think being able to follow through with your patients would be pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I have, you know, four generations of one family, you know, can be,
wow,
seeing me, you know, for different reasons, you know, through the week. And so I get to follow up on kind of all aspects on their lives and,
yes,
keep in touch with them as they, you know, all grow up together.
Yeah, that's cool. Lovely. So there's a really rewarding aspect to having that personal touch, that face-to-face continuity.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a lot of variety as well. You can never guess what you're going to be faced with next.
Yeah, yeah. And you get to knock off and have dinner with your family, which is really cool.
Yeah, usually.
Yeah. Canoponics might be changing that a little bit.
Yeah, well, yeah, now with Canoponics, I, you know, my other wife, really, sort of, I live and breathe, I'm living and breathing cannabis medicine at the moment. And, yeah, Canoponics has really got my attention and I'm really enjoying learning a lot of different skills.
Yeah, man, it seems every time I speak to you, you've got a little deeper into that, this cannabis thing, man, and you're more embracing every time as well, which is really good to see.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a real rabbit hole, rabbit warren you get drawn down into. And I think everyone that kind of starts learning and reading up on any part of the plant and the medicine kind of really gets drawn in and gets really excited. And I've definitely found that.
Yeah, I think speaking from my personal experience, being a bit more skeptical, we're getting back onto the cannabis journey, and perhaps reading for a purpose, not to prove anything to myself, but to disprove to myself.
Mm.
And I think the more I read, the more I realized I was not going to be able to disprove this whole cannabis is medicine.
Yeah.
And it's legit. Like the facts just keep coming in. They keep stacking up. The science is resounding.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the experience, you know, is really, really convincing. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about lack of objective evidence, and the sort of huge amount of anecdotal evidence. But when you're kind of living in the anecdotal kind of evidence, it really is convincing. It's very hard to be skeptical.
Yeah.
And to retain some sort of scientific kind of rigor.
Yeah, I understand, I guess, the apprehension from the medical community in really coming out and saying, hey, this is straight up legit. But I guess you need those pioneers to establish the data that's required for other people who we'll mention later. And you're part of that pioneering sort of effort here.
Thanks. Well, you know, as with everything, every new invention or every new technology or every new treatment, there's a kind of bell curve of attitudes, with the sort of early adopters and the pioneers, and then the early majority and the late majority and the laggards. And it's nice to be on the kind of pointy end of that and be hopefully dragging a few people with me into the early majority. And I think one of the reasons why I got into cannabis medicine is that my patients are well ahead of, you know, the medical fraternity on the curve.
Mm-hmm.
So I purely got into it because I was being bombarded with questions by my patients, you know, all the time. And speaking to my other GP colleagues, you know, they were saying the same things. And often the attitude is, you know, it's a bit annoying to be asked about these things. But for me, I kind of twigged that, you know, there's so much demand there. You know, someone's got to be ready to kind of look into it, and someone's got to be ready to, provide the answers to these people. So I think that's what really kickstarted my kind of interest in learning about cannabis medicine, how to prescribe, how to get into it, and seeking, you know, other peers to discuss this with and be kind of gain knowledge from them.
Yeah, I discussed it with Matty Moore when he was on the show, where I guess there's a daunting aspect to doing that. You know what I mean? Where I assume when you started really engaging with this, the RACGP still had a fairly negative sort of outlook towards it. Was there?
Do you know what? I didn't really sort of leaf through the RACGP's recommendations. Didn't really worry me, but I was lucky compared to Matt Moore, really, who's quite isolated down south in Dunsborough, because I joined a cannabis clinic, which kind of provided me with a lot of support and a lot of really great people to kind of sound ideas off, and which I won't name drop now, but it was a great time working with them, and really wonderful people, and learned a lot. But I personally wanted to be working alone with more freedom and more flexibility, and not feel that anyone can kind of direct the treatment that I give other than myself and the patients.
That's really cool. So you end up at Canoponics. How did you end up with these guys?
Good question. That because the way it came about is I gave a brief talk to a cancer charity on behalf of my previous employer, and it was moderately well received. Not fantastic. And you know, a few weeks after doing that, you know, Rod and Salim got in touch with me, and we caught up for lunch and had a good chat, and we just found that we really kind of clicked and gelled. And really, you know, they were kind of who I was looking for, and I was who they were looking for, and it really just kicked off from there. So I will say I'd left my previous employer before I started working with them or even contacting them. But we sort of fitted together well. So I kind of found that, you know, having had a lot of experience with a lot of patients, I thought, well, maybe I do have some value to add to the industry. So I was kind of looking around for a kind of industry to, you know, players to work with. And preferably, you know, a startup where you have high risk, but, you know, a lot of exposure to all parts of the business and a lot of learning across all parts of the business and a lot of influence. So, yeah, we fit together really well. And I've learned so much from my time in Canoponics already.
Yeah, that's cool. I can attest to that you fit really well with the guys because we've had several dinners together and you guys as a group.
We're a close group.
You're really cool.
We're a really close group.
Yeah, the conversation flows. Everybody seems happy. You fit really nicely. I think there's three different personalities, but you all complement each other really nicely.
Yeah, and the team's expanding, so there's, you know, more like seven or eight different personalities now.
Yeah.
And still a very lean, small group, but we have great chemistry. Yeah.
That's really nice, cool, man. That's really cool. So, I want to get onto the medical fraternity a little bit straight away. I'm fascinated by this pioneering aspect that you guys do, the things that you go through, and perhaps the way that some of your colleagues or counterparts may not share the same impressions as you.
Yep.
And there may be perhaps a reluctance to engage with people such as yourself that have the knowledge and have the experience.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's the, go on.
So I just wanted to talk about some comments that were made by ANSCA, the dean professor of ANSCA, who I'm sure very well intentioned, but he made some quite derogatory remarks about cannabis as a pain medication. What do you feel? How did you feel when you saw those comments?
Yeah, obviously I thought that, you know, it's very unhelpful to the patients, you know. I think that the industry is going to be okay, you know, and I don't think anyone's opinion is going to derail the industry or the progression of, you know, of cannabis as a medicine and something that can help people. But it's pretty unhelpful to the patients. So the patients are already quite relatively, or a good majority of people are relatively poorly informed about cannabis medicine, and this is just going to muddy the waters, you know, further. I do wonder why, or, you know, what the reasons are behind kind of the thought processes and of the comments that were made. One thing, I think that all the comments were taken in isolation and out of context.
Yeah.
You know, and another thing I think I've mentioned previously is that in some ways it's true, you know, in some ways alcohol numbs emotional and physical pain. So, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, untrue that alcohol is a painkiller. But to put the two in the same basket, you know, it's really comparing apples and oranges, you know, in terms of harm.
Yeah, I think for the greater context of legalization, potential long-term legalization, I think I kind of personally, I appreciate people like that comparing alcohol with cannabis. As an advocate myself, I think in the psyche of society and the general public, I think it's the best possible way for people to relate to the information. So it's going to be impossible to have apples with apples, but this is probably as close as you're going to get where you have a substance on the recreational side of things where people can consume typically for relaxation and yep. stress relief.
Yep. Yep.
And then if you put it in that context and people can start relating the two, you can start perhaps looking at data that we do have currently relating the harm that the two can cause to the consumer.
Yeah, when you talk about recreational legalization of cannabis, yeah, absolutely we should be comparing the harms of cannabis to the harms of smoking cigarettes, drinking alcohol and other illegal drugs, because that really does illustrate, you know, the low levels of harm and the low levels of kind of public expense, you know, that recreational use of cannabis kind of causes. So yeah, I agree.
But as far as alcohol is concerned, as for you as a doctor and a prescriber, I guess I see what you're saying, that it can give some fairly reckless messages across to people. Go and smash a half bottle of vodka to get over your pain or something along those lines.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and some doctors prescribe, you know, Valium as a painkiller, or diazepam is known as a painkiller, and that's kind of, well, it's not a painkiller, it's a sedative, and it and an anxiolytic, so it settles anxiety. So people feel like their pain has improved, you know, because their worries or their attention to the pain has decreased.
So it's about perception, is that?
Yeah, and alcohol does, you know, will do the same thing.
Yeah,
and often alcohol is all people have close to hand, and a lot of people have learned to fall back on alcohol for many reasons, you know.
I feel as though the message that Professor Vag was trying to put across, I hope it was coming from the right place. I hope the message he was trying to put across was, we need more data.
Yes.
We need more information, and we need widespread clinical trials, and we can – that way we have some level of control over the application of this as medicine. And once we've got that data, then we can start to pursue it. I just feel it just seems so contradictory to what I hear from prescribing GPs such as yourself, such as Matty Moore, that there are people that are, I mean, as far as pain goes, it's like one of the primary reasons you would prescribe, right?
Yeah, it's the most common reason to prescribe, really, still. I guess I would say that the benefit of cannabis as a medicine is that we actually have already, you know, thousands of years of evidence to show, you know, safety or low levels of harm, as compared to alcohol, where we have, you know, hundreds of years of evidence to show that there is very high levels of harm.
Yeah,
you know, we were mentioning that cannabis is potentially a good option for controlling stress, and that might be a reason why a lot of people recreationally use cannabis. And the cannabis might be an option, you know, to relieve stress rather than alcohol. And of course, you know, a couple of cans of beer will relax you and relieve your stress, but it might also lead to, you know, harms to organs like the liver, risks of, you know, addiction. As people's kind of tolerance increases, it becomes a few more cans of beer after a few more months and so on. And, you know, people's sleep is absolutely worse with alcohol on board and less refreshing. And so people will wake up, you know, less, being less productive the next day. And obviously there's, you know, associated other harms such as, you know, violence and driving problems and just lowered inhibitions, which kind of lead to, you know, worsening interpersonal relationships. People say things that they obviously regret.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, with cannabis, you know, the sleep architecture can be maintained or improved. So if someone takes THC to help them sleep and relax, they're more likely to wake up and feel more productive and more rested. And of course, there's no association with violence, and there's, you know, there's no real association with any other organ damage, and a very, very low risk of addiction.
So if we put it in context with perhaps some of the more commonly issued medications, even over-the-counter medications. I mean, one really great thing about cannabis is the lack or the inability to consume a fatal dose.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yep. You have to be run over by, you know, a truck that's delivering the cannabis to the pharmacy.
Yeah, so that's
or fascinating. Or you have to drown in the oil, which is unaffordable.
One thing that always confuses me, particularly with political stances and things, is perhaps this concept that that cannabis is so dangerous. I don't discredit negative outcomes from cannabis abuse,
yeah,
and some people do have some issues with it. But you know, we can go to a Dan Murphy's, as mentioned by Professor Bagg. We can go to a Dan Murphy's and we can quite easily purchase more than enough to die, and maybe to kill 10 people in a room.
Yep.
You know, we can load up a trolley with alcohol, and nobody blinks.
Yep, that's right.
So, yeah, it was kind of comical, I guess, the comments about Dan Murphy's not having extended opening hours for pain patients.
Yep. I mean, it's very unusual to have any medication or drug that's that safe.
Yeah, it's probably, so what about paracetamol? Does that have a fatal dose?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And is it achievable?
Oh, easily achievable. I mean, in the UK, you can only buy 20 Panadol at a time, 20 paracetamol at a time. The pharmacist will pick you up if you kind of walk in, buy 20 Panadol, walk out, try to walk back in and get 20 more. It's very tightly controlled. Over here, obviously, we can buy
it at Coles.
Yeah, we can buy, and you can only buy 20 at a time, I believe, in Coles, but in the pharmacy, you can buy enough to kill yourself very simply. Yeah. The good thing about Panadol is there's a reversing agent if we catch the time, and it's very easy to test for run a blood test to check for the poisoning. So that's a good thing. But that's true. It's very dangerous in overdose.
I'm going to put something out there because I don't really make this public, but I may as well in the spirit of this conversation, I have personally revived and resuscitated somebody, a friend who had consumed 400 paracetamol tablets and over 2 liters of spirits and tried to take their own life that way. So I guess personally some of those comments are offensive to me about – you may as well go to Dan Murphy's and get some alcohol and go along these paths. I think the whole journey that person went on to get to that state revolved around alcoholism and possibly pain as well.
Untreated pain or poorly treated pain.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's a weird one, and I just hope over the coming years as a whole, society can sort of frame it a bit differently and maybe understand a little better just how lucky we are to have access currently to a medication which has such a low risk factor.
Yeah, and risk of death in overdose is just one of the things to think about. And but across the board of all the other risks, you know, with cannabis, the risks are all very low, even dependence at medicinal dosing and you know, even risk of harm in traffic or risk of harm to others in any other way, the risk is still very low.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, so you talk about the risk of harm for traffic incidents, and we've had Dr. Thomas Arkell on the show. I thank you for the shout-out on that episode as well.
It was great to listen to.
Really nice words. Thank you very much. So
great work he did there.
Thank you. And I mean, that's all back to Thomas Arkell and the Lambert Initiative, who just do great things for this field, for our industry. And I guess if listeners haven't heard that particular episode, those guys established that perhaps as little as six hours after consumption, the level of impairment will be almost irrecognizable.
Yeah.
And perhaps 12 hours after, well, we know 12 hours after consumption, they're non-existent.
Mm-hmm. Just correct me if I'm wrong, is that inhaled?
Vaporized? Vaporized cannabis. Vaporized or was it smoked? It was inhaled though, that's correct.
Yeah, it's just got a short, short duration of action.
Yeah, but the one interesting thing was they were people who were experienced consumers, but they had to have a tolerance break in the lead up.
Right. Yeah.
So I guess
it's very hard to control for those sort of things.
Oh, it is. But they were tested. So I believe they had some urine samples done before they were allowed onto the program.
Yep.
So they knew that they had a tolerance break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So of course, you can you do obviously develop tolerance for alcohol. All right, but you'd never to the extent where your driving would be permissible. At a over 0.05 BAL. So it's good with alcohol that we have the sort of threshold, the cutoff, the agreed upon sort of threshold for how intoxicated you can be. And it's just a shame with cannabis we have no other method of
it's no baseline.
Tracking impairment. And hopefully, you know, that's the sort of very Tom's work there is the sort of very basis of the very first study in a list of studies that are going to kind of clarify these sort of things. But I mean, I guess what we need is a roadside intoxication test, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very simple case of walking a straight
sobriety,
line. Sobriety. Correct,
yeah. Like so
the Americans.
North America. Exactly. So it's fascinating because you see on some of those traffic shows and the cop shows some of those sobriety tests as an Australian, and it looks quite fascinating. You go, wow, they're a bit behind the times there. But when you put it in the context of cannabis, it's probably the best way to go about things, right?
Because I mean, currently, a medicinal cannabis patient, someone who we've prescribed cannabis to very, very much legally, you know, two layers of government have authorized this, can give some THC containing medication a go, you know, give it a go for 2 weeks, decide they don't like it, cease it for 2 weeks or more, and then be in a car crash a couple of weeks after they've even ceased it. Through no fault of their own, they just happen to be the driver of one of the vehicles, have a blood test taken which will show THC, and be penalized for having THC in their system, even though there's no way that they can possibly be intoxicated. So it's a very discriminatory rule at the moment.
Yeah, for sure. And that must be quite frustrating for you as a prescriber.
It's frustrating.
Your patients have to, I guess, make a choice, don't they?
Patients have to take the risk, really. Yep. Their options for cannabis-based medications are very, very limited.
Yeah, and we're about to have harsher laws brought into place July 1st here in WA for drug consumption or having it in your system and failing a drug test, a roadside drug test, which to me seems like we're kind of going the wrong way. So, yeah, that's something hopefully people such as us can get onto some of those people in politics, some of the legislators to maybe make a bit of noise.
And with my position in canoponics, we're occasionally in the ear of some influential people, and we're always in contact with lots of other people, you know, in the state that are in contact with some influential people. So hopefully, we'll be able to kind of help advocate for our patients.
Are you familiar with the Legalized Cannabis WA party? Have you met those guys?
I haven't. I've chatted to Brian.
Yeah, cool.
Walker, but I haven't actually physically met him. I've had good things about him from my, you know, some of my colleagues in the industry. I think I'm booked into catch up with him in a couple of weeks' time.
That's cool.
Yeah. So no, I hadn't really heard much about the Legalized Cannabis Party prior to their election result.
I think it was fairly quick that they put it all together and made it happen. So.
Yeah, I mean, and fair play to Brian as well, because he mentioned that they really got voted into the Senate off the back of somewhere around 50 votes and as a sort of second as a party preference. So, and he was the first to say that it was a relatively undemocratic process, but it's kind of fortuitous for us. And it's a bit of a foot in the door for us. And I'll be chatting to him, and we'll hopefully be, you know, helping each other out in the future. And I think really, you know, that we have to be with our targets, with the political kind of ambitions here. I mean, I think we probably have to move in a very sort of slow and stepwise approach. And I don't think things are going to turn around for legalization here very soon. But if we can kind of gain parity with the other states and kind of just pay attention to how things are moving in the ACT with the recent legalization there, then yeah, I think we'll just keep moving things along. It's going to be a slow process.
I think Victoria is starting to look at it a little deeper now as well.
Yeah, and with the big, you know, as the big eastern states kind of make changes, then you know the smaller states will be dragged along. I'm sure of it, and it's the same as happened in the US as well.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's good to see it going in the right direction. Anyway,
yeah, there's a lot of, you know, obvious financial, health, you know, legal, kind
and
of
social, I think.
And social, yeah. So, you know, from incarceration rates and legal fees, and
I think even to be honest,
leasing fees.
We've discussed alcohol and some of the harmful effects of alcohol, and I think even if I know cannabis isn't right for everybody, but if some people perhaps are better off on cannabis than on alcohol, and they're people that say, hey, I need my reward at the end of the day or whatever it may be, I'm sure that there are people that society can benefit. We could, as a society, can benefit from having some people swap it out. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'll have that option. Yeah, absolutely.
Even the violence, you know, domestic violence and things like that, I'm sure you could see, I'm sure the data will be supportive of it if it were to take place.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about the first line treatment thing. Something you hear discussed a lot in the medical cannabis sort of chat rooms and things like that. And it's a little bit cloudy as to what the reality is. So can you explain as a prescriber, what are the restrictions on you in prescribing, and when can a patient actually get that prescription and get access?
Yeah, I can explain. So, you know, permission for prescribing cannabis has to be granted by the TGA, the Therapeutic Goods Administration. So they have just a set criteria that they judge everybody's application by. And one of those criteria is that it cannot be used as a first-line treatment. The patient should have reasonably exhausted all other, you know, conventional avenues of treatment. So what that means in reality is, as you get kind of a bit more confident prescribing, really that the patient should have tried a few different classes of medications for that condition where possible. So for example, for pain, that might include an opiate, a non-opiate analgesic like Panadol and Nurofen, and potentially another adjunct painkiller like Lyrica or pregabalin or gabapentin, which is an anticonvulsant. And if they've tried an antidepressant or a tricyclic antidepressant like amitriptyline for their pain as well, that's helpful. And ideally, you know, you want to take the opportunity to encourage engaging with physios, engaging with psychologists, simple lifestyle changes and weight loss and sleep hygiene measures and things that can obviously complement their treatment. And if they've made a reasonable effort to try, you know, several classes of treatment, then I believe they're eligible to try medicinal cannabis treatment. Also, I personally believe that it can be interpreted that if a patient strongly is against trying a class of medicine because of the risk of or concerns about side effects or dependence or adverse effects, events, then I believe that actually also kind of accounts in their favor for their application.
So here in WA, it goes through the TGA, but then it also has to go through WA Health. Yeah. Is that correct?
So the TGA will put the final stamp on whether the patient is eligible as per their criteria.
Sure.
Then the through the SASB scheme, which is the sort of main scheme that most people get their treatment kind of validated through. The application is then pushed to the WA Health Department. And each state is slightly different, but WA Health will then just make sure that the patient isn't what they deem to be a high-risk patient. So a patient who's registered as a drug-dependent person or someone who's under 18 or someone who's on Occasionally they judge that someone's on too high a doses of other Schedule 8 medications.
Sure.
And they will then write back and say, okay, you're authorized to prescribe THC up to a certain point, or cannabis up to a certain dosage. So it's slightly labor intensive here in WA.
What's the sort of turnaround? So a patient comes into you write a prescription, an application. Sorry, sort of turnaround do we get?
It's variable actually, because there's times when the TGA are quite flooded with applications, and that's usually when a brand runs out of stock in the country, and so there's a rush on new applications for alternative brands. So during those times, the TGA can take a week and WA can take a couple of days.
Yeah.
So generally it's sort of a week's time.
Now you talk about the patient perhaps refusing a class of medication, and I guess one that comes straight to mind is the opiate side of things. And I guess one of the common themes from a lot of people within government and politics is this whole theory that cannabis is a gateway drug.
Yeah.
I mean, in the US, we seem to be seeing data that suggests that it's perhaps an exit drug for opiates.
Yeah. If cannabis was a gateway drug, then all the states that had legalized, recreational access to cannabis would have an even bigger heroin problem.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas they, the data shows that
it's a reduction.
Yeah, there's a reduction in harm from opiates.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's fascinating and it's good to hear it from a
And now there's a lot of, we're encouraged to really de-prescribe opiates anyway.
Yeah.
There's a push, push from the College of Pain Medicine, the RACGP, and from the state to reduce our prescribing of opiates. And that's, the thing is, that's actually, It's true, opiates have actually minimal benefits in long-term in chronic pain because of tolerance.
So you do build tolerance the same as you do for alcohol.
Enormously, obviously. Okay. So really the pain score for somebody who's on a high dose of opiates is probably the same as what theirs will be once their pain score will be once they've weaned off of opiates 6 months later. Uh-huh. So that's why they say that there's minimal benefit. Because if you encourage someone to wean themselves completely off opiates, their pain score would be 8 out of 10. Yeah. But they would say, once they've become intolerant to their opiate treatment, they would say their pain score is 8 out of 10. Right?
Yeah, okay.
So they have the side effects of opiates like dysphoria, like feeling funny, or constipation, or risk of overdose causing respiratory depression, but with still 8 out of 10 pain at the end of the day. So it's true that opiates are relatively useless in chronic pain because before long, pain goes back to its, high baseline. So that's part of the dependency profile of opiates. Quite quickly, they stop working. So you seek more or a higher dose or more frequent dosing.
And in your experience with cannabis as a pain medication, what have your observations been?
Yeah, generally people reduce their opiate requirement. Mm-hmm. Generally people are very motivated to reduce their opiate requirement because very few people these days really want to be on opiates.
Yep.
And cannabis enables them to reduce it. And I don't think they necessarily have to cease all opiates. Mm-hmm. I think that opiates and cannabinoids can be complementary and additive in their effect. So you could probably have a low dose of each working better than a high dose of one by themselves. And that's kind of a common approach to pain anyway, is to have multiple low doses of agents,
That's fascinating. I guess pound for pound, the comparison made with alcohol, pound for pound with opiates. Yeah. In my mind, I can't assume or can't imagine that cannabis immediately to somebody that hasn't built up tolerance, I can't imagine that it's as effective in pain relief as an opiate.
No, I think if someone has extremely strong or acute pain, opiates work better. And if certain people have certain types of pain for which cannabis may not work so well. So I often find, with pain from osteoarthritis, which is essentially, you know, wear and tear and direct damage to the joints, I find it very hard to control that pain for most patients. So, you know, opiates kind of sometimes more helpful for those patients than cannabis. So some people have a miraculous response to CBD or THC or both. It's very hard. It's very hard to tell from looking at someone how they're going to respond to all these medicines. You have to just suck it and see, you know, give it a try. So there's certain conditions, that respond better to opiates than cannabis. But I would say that, you know, the cohort of patients that need pain relief for osteoarthritis are the ones that suffer the worst side effects from opiates, like constipation and risk of falling.
Yeah. You know?
So it's good to have an alternative for these older patients. And I'd say that the majority of my patients and most prescribers' patients for cannabis medicine are older people.
Yeah, and that sort of dispels this myth that people are doctor shopping and they're trying to get a legal drug dealer.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's a lot of effort to come and justify yourself to a doctor to get a cannabis script. And it's, you know, the cost is coming down. The cost of the products are quite competitive with the black market now.
Yep.
Obviously, the quality is, immensely different. I don't see a huge number of patients coming for kind of legal access to their preferred. I was going to say poison, but their preferred substance.
Well, that's good feedback. And while we're on the topic of first line treatments. I just want to ask a question. Suppose the TGA all of a sudden declared cannabis is a authorized medicine. So registered medications.
Yep.
And you all of a sudden have the ability to prescribe cannabis.
Front line.
Mm. What sort of ailments or indications would you be inclined to sort of gravitate towards cannabis first?
Yeah, that's a good question. One of the reasons why there's this sort of insistence that it's a second line or, you know, last line medication is because of the lack of safety evidence. But, you know, from experience, I find that it's extremely safe.
Yeah.
So, and tolerated better than a lot of the medications that you have to prescribe first line, which, you know, they're not guaranteed to have side effects, but when, you know, they do have predictable side effect profiles. So in one way, you know, for a lot of conditions, cannabis is less risky. So it doesn't quite make sense that it's not first line. But obviously we've got to wait for the evidence and time will tell. If I was to, if you were to make me choose a single condition, well, I mean, THC gives profound relief from insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to just be a great treatment for sleep problems.
Yeah, it's such a common thing that you hear people say, they consume some cannabis and they woke up feeling great the next day.
Yeah, you hear that. And, you know, sleep issues are probably, you know, affect everybody, absolutely everybody. And there's probably no one alive that hasn't had a sleepless night for one reason or another. And there's probably not many people out there who haven't had one of those nights where, you know, they've just really stressed about getting enough sleep because they've got to perform the next day.
Yep.
And or because they've had a couple of bad nights of sleep prior and they just can't unwind. And the more you stress about sleeping, the worse it becomes. And everyone can identify with that. So there is a need out there for good sleep medications in this, you know, and it's probably a societal thing where none of us have enough rest and we all spend too much time online and et cetera, et cetera. So I would say, you know, one, THC seems to work extremely well for sleep and giving a restful sleep. And two, the risks, you know, associated with cannabis treatment as compared to the other sleep medications, you know, it's chalk and cheese. It's very different. So other sleep first line sleep medications being, you know, benzodiazepines, mm-hmm. and similar drugs like Zopiclone, the Z drugs, antidepressants like tricyclic antidepressants, including amitriptyline, or other antidepressants like mirtazapine, or even antihistamines that you can buy over the counter, Phenergan, which is promethazine, and Restivit, which is doxylamine. So the safety and the side effect profile even seems to be better than those over-the-counter medications.
you know, from my observation.
Yeah.
So I would love to kind of go down. I would love to be able to offer it for short-term or long-term sleep problems.
With your role at Canoponics, are there any, I guess, goals to run some clinical trials?
Yeah.
Is there anything that you'd hope to achieve?
Yeah, we surely will. You know, we surely will. So I've been discussing with a few, you know, academics, just sort of making making some contacts in a few local Perth universities, and you know, the time will come when we can announce what sort of things
that's
up to. But we definitely want to be kind of driving the knowledge base forward, and I think with any, you know, with any cannabis company, the holy grail is a sort of is a patentable,
yeah,
kind of you know, protectable a pharmaceutical approach, you know. So a lot of people are drawn to the cannabis medicine because it's not big pharma.
Yeah.
But at the moment, all, you know, anyone is really getting is a generic.
Yeah.
So any cannabis that's extracted into an oil, or any cannabis that's provided as a dried flower, really is a generic. There's just no, you know, secret sauce.
Yeah.
That this company owns and that company doesn't. And really the only way that there's ever going to be funding, you know, in cannabis medicine is if the the results give something that can be, you know, financially worthwhile.
Protected and replicated.
So that's the kind of reality. That's the kind of reality of it. So really you need the pharmaceutical approach to provide cannabis-based medicines to, you know, to have any hope of having cannabis-based medications being PBS listed, you know, or in other words, subsidized for patient use. And so we're kind of seeing that happen, you know, across the world at the moment, slowly.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like you say, a lot of people that gravitate towards cannabis have that big pharma thing in their head, and they hate it.
Yep.
But I guess the industry needs to develop some sort of base, some sort of stability. And
big pharma are coming, you know.
Yeah.
And the reason is because, you know, they have huge profits. They have a huge amount of money. And if someone starts to take a nibble out of their profits,
yep, they're going
to, be it as an alternative to their, you know, patented medication, they're going to probably think about having kind of a slice of that.
Yeah.
So it will happen. And we've seen with Epidiolex in America, which is FDA, which is the, you know, Federal Drugs Administration over there. It's an approved medication for epilepsy and rare forms of epilepsy in childhood. We've seen, you know, big pharma kind of swoop in for them. And I don't know about you, but have you ever heard of Jazz Pharmaceuticals?
No.
So, you know, you think of big pharma as being one of the sort of names that you know, like GlaxoSmithKline or AstraZeneca or something. But Jazz bought out the parent company, GW Pharmaceuticals, for $7 billion off the back of one drug registration.
They've done quite a few clinical trials though, right, GW Pharmaceuticals?
Yeah, so they've done the hard yards. They've done sort of probably, I can't remember, it's 10 or 15 years worth of work.
Yeah.
And probably a few billion dollars to get one drug, which is purely CBD, registered for one extremely rare, you know, condition.
Wow, okay.
But the payoff is that their medication is now FDA approved, and it can be prescribed off-label and funded by, you know, these huge American health insurance funds. So they never really, you know, Epidiolex is never going to be cheap, even though it's registered, because it's the health insurance companies that are kind of paying for it, not the the poor patient.
You hear stories about the these pharmaceutical companies perhaps putting funding towards lobbying for anti-legalization and things. I'm sure if that were to be occurring, I'm sure some level of that would be to protect perhaps future investments. So you talk about the generic aspect of cannabis. If you just take raw flower off a for any source, there's a generic aspect to it.
Yep.
But if they are able to gather clinical trials and data and a recipe, perhaps they might see that as the time to come in, and perhaps then they won't be putting their finances towards lobbying.
Yeah, Yeah, I don't know if they're lobbying or not.
Yeah.
I guess the reason why the pharma companies wouldn't be happy to see cannabis going mainstream is because, you know, it's a competitor. It's a potential market competitor for multiple drugs.
Right? Yeah, well, I mean, we discuss the exit strategy for opiates.
Yeah, but, there's nothing confirmed as yet, but thoughts that it could be helpful for, things like as diverse as schizophrenia, mm-hmm. Inflammatory bowel disease, inflammatory arthritis. Of course, there's epilepsy. There's nausea and anorexia or cachexia of any cause, various types of pain, sleep, which would have a huge market and, a huge amount of money made from benzos and similar. Yep. So, yeah, I think that there'd be a lot of worry by a lot of drug companies across a lot of aspects of healthcare.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I want to bring up a story that I heard on another podcast where you were chatting.
My other
that
podcast.
You brought up.
Sorry, buddy.
Yeah, Alt Med. So I'll give him a shout out. Alt Buddies. Med. It was a cool interview. Thank I really you. Enjoyed that one.
Yeah, thanks.
And like I say, every time I meet you, you're more invested. I can see it in your face right now. You're fully sold now, which is really cool.
Yeah, there's no going back now, is there?
Yeah, that's it, man. Now, you told a story about a colleague from, was it Emerald or your previous clinic, where they had prescribed cannabis to a patient and the patient had an issue and ended up in emergency. And is that correct? And they were prescribed by accident 10 times.
Yeah, dosage? I think that's how the story went. Yeah, so they were given 10 times what was kind of written down for them to take. So that's physically a difficult thing to do because it means you're refilling, the 1 mL syringe 5 times instead of having half a syringe. Yep. The patient just mentioned the next day that they'd never slept so good or and they were feeling great. So there's not, like I said before, there's just no other drugs where you could kind of get that margin of error. And in fact, I had another patient with a similar story very recently who misread, 0.4 mils of a strong THC oil as 4 mils. And so on their third day of, for some reason, on their third day or fourth day of taking the medication, they kind of times 10 their dose as well. And wow. I must say that it's not recommended because people with a high dose of THC, when you're naive, you can feel like you're going to die. You can feel so incredibly anxious
and
that you're having
time,
a heart attack.
People talk about time and they feel like time's not moving or something along those lines.
Is that from personal?
Let's get back onto the topic.
It's really not advisable to do it because you can feel very awful, but and people land up in emergency departments because they feel so awful if they've, taken a, you hear stories about people who have eaten a whole brownie and not known what's in it and, feel awful for days. So you do feel awful, but if that's, that's the worst kind of amount of harm that you'll come to, a severe panic attack.
Do you have any recommendations you would give to a patient who feels as though maybe the heart rate is rising and they're getting a bit of that panic or that anxiety or paranoia? Do you have any tips that you would offer?
I guess the thing is, if you're pre-warned, if you can pre-warn your patient, not to do it for that reason, and even, sometimes just out of the blue on someone's normal dose, they can get similar symptoms for who knows what reason. Maybe they just absorbed quicker that day because of a change in sort of diet. You just simply have to remain calm. And not let the sort of thoughts of anxiety-provoking thoughts spiral out of control. And if someone's informed beforehand, that this is how you can feel, one, so don't do it, and two, if you do do it, you're not going to come to any harm, then, it's less likely to kind of spiral out of control and land them in the emergency department. But it's, I guess, another thing that's helpful would be to discuss with their other half or their family members to watch out for it and to just try and calm them down and settle things down and keep an eye on them and reassure them. Because it can be the reason probably why patients end up in emergency is because their family will call
the ambulance
because it looks scary too.
It can scare.
A severe panic attack looks very scary.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had a guest that I had a chat with. His name was Jeff, the 420 chef. He's a Jeff Danza, sorry, was his name. He is a chef in California, in Hollywood, and he's quite into low-dose edibles and scaling up consumption for the recreational market over there. He got into it from a medicinal point of view for people who had cancer, late-stage cancer, and didn't want to vaporize or smoke but wanted to consume it through their food. But in researching that episode, I read his book, which was I think called The Gourmet 420 or Cookbook or something along those lines. And he had an interesting little reference in there about people who may be experiencing these effects. And he referenced a piece of research which was conducted, I think, in 2018. Don't quote me on that, but I believe it may have been then, which may have indicated that ibuprofen can perhaps take away these extreme effects.
I haven't heard that, and haven't heard that. I don't know how that would work.
Yeah,
I mean, some people, you know, obviously some people talk about CBD being able to balance the sort of negative effects of THC.
Yeah.
And I've heard stories of high dose, you know, CBD being used to kind of
balance. Is it the anti-inflammatory side of things, perhaps?
Yeah, maybe, or maybe just sort of as that sort of competitor at the CB1 receptor, competitively kind of occupying it. So I've heard about that, but I don't know how true that is. And then I think another podcast I've listened to said that from the experiences of the Dutch cafes, you know, I think there might
be honey and
maybe
have some
sugar.
On my podcast.
Yeah, some sugar and you know, some sugar and a cup of tea, and trying not to call the ambulance. Yeah.
That I my first guest, Tom Forrest, definitely referenced that.
Might have been from your back catalogue.
Yeah, that's possible. It's fascinating anyway. I will flick you through that link to the research that he sort of quoted. Now, CBD, just one interesting thing I wanted to quickly throw out there. You know, anti-inflammatory properties, sure, okay. But are you aware of I believe that if it's consumed in excess, it may have inflammatory properties.
That's possible, I guess, because I recently had a chat to a medical director of another cannabis company, another cannabis company that's pretty huge, and he's an extremely experienced, you know, research professor. His thought was that oral CBD oil in high doses can cause dysregulation of the endocannabinoid system.
Mm-hmm.
So we sort of see the in the gut, you know, oil is swallowed, and therefore causing kind of IBS symptoms or causing pro-inflammatory, you know, changes. So I guess the thing is, with any substance is a poison in the right dose, right? So oxygen is a poison and water is a poison if you have enough of them. So and you can easily, you know, you can easily kill yourself by drinking 7 liters of water. You know, that's it's poisonous to drink that much water in one go. You dilute yourself. So anything is a poison. So with the endocannabinoid system being a very subtle and broad, you know, system within the body, with lots of widespread but quite subtle effects, it's clearly going to be negative effects to overstimulating it or inappropriately stimulating it. So I guess it's possible, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Before we wrap up, I want to talk a little bit about Canaponics. I mean, I know you guys have things down the track that you want to release and you don't want to divulge too much now, but I just want to ask where you guys are at. I mean, our listeners are probably not familiar with you guys unless they're from WA potentially or people that are really, really fascinated by the scene in the eastern states of Australia. But we have a lot of overseas listeners.
Hi, Mum.
There you go. I hope she does tune in. And hi, Mrs. Chalk. thank you for listening. I just wanted to ask what you guys are up to. Tell people a bit about Canaponics and what you guys hope to achieve.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, I mean, Canaponics was started a few years before I came on board. I've been around for sort of only 6 months now, really. And we've kind of led by a very a powerful personality called Rod Zakaselski. So he's kind of got the whole ball rolling, and now the team's kind of coming together to take it all to the next level. So we have 160 acres in Colley, which is a rural town in the southwest of WA. And Colley is a coal mining town, and really built on a coal mining kind of heritage, and has two coal power stations, coal burning power stations in the vicinity. So coal has obviously had its day, and the time is approaching for the mining and the power stations to be phased out, you know, in the town. So it's a town that's kind of facing a kind of lack of employment potentially, and a lack of industry. So it's really a town that's looking for a new industry and a new, you know, new lease of life. So we have 160 acres there. We have a full, you know, full suite of licenses now on that land from the Office of Drug Control. So we're able to grow, cultivate, research, and manufacture cannabis-based medicines on site there. We are, you know, at the stage of beginning to clear, you know, level the land over the probably this month coming, and begin our construction of a 2,000 square meter, you know, warehouse and manufacturing plant, and 3,600 square meter greenhouse, so we can do like large scale greenhouse grow. And the really, really exciting part of that is that we're going to be powering that almost entirely from on-site solar farm. And we're going to be watering those plants, which are, as you know, extremely thirsty, with entirely harvested rainwater. So the town has been polluted, and the water table has been, you know, near exhausted, and the local water, you know, there's a lot of pressure on it. It's very salty, and if we were to desalinate, we've got to send some, you know, really nasty saline somewhere. So we must go fully green then, fully renewable, so that, you know, we're hoping to kind of get, you know, re-green the town in a way. And so we'll have, you know, like I say, almost entirely controlling our input costs, which is, you know, power and water are one of the kind of highest costs to any manufacturing process. So we'll be able to kind of probably be able to declare ourselves the first, you know, fully green, fully renewable cannabis company, at least in the country, if not the world.
Yeah, you know, I love that. Yeah, you know, really I love cool, the plan. Right?
And we've been engaging with the town, you know, and the locals, and they're really happy to see us, and they're really happy to kind of we're prioritizing them, you know, for the local tradespeople and contracts and so on, and they're all really interested in kind of working with us, or how they can help us, or how we can help each other and bring each other up, and it's just a great it's a really uplifting story.
That's really cool. Yeah, I this is one project out there that I really hope completes and goes to full fruition, because on so many levels, you know, the reinvigoration of a town that may have been facing a pretty bleak future.
Well, there's no stopping us now.
Yeah, that's cool.
We've got the investment, and there's a lot of interest in investing with us, because people can, you know, I'm not going to hand out the numbers, but the numbers, you know, they work out really in our favor. There's absolutely no stopping us now. We aim to be growing, harvesting and producing really high quality, you know, fully Australian manufactured quality medicines within a year.
That's awesome.
I know.
That's really cool.
I know. And so I see, you know, my role here as I'm a GP. So, you know, I'm not a professor of anything. I'm not I don't declare myself to be a world renowned expert, or I'm just someone who sees a lot of patients, talks to a lot of patients about cannabis medicine and how it works, how it doesn't work, what they need, what they like, what they enjoy, what they don't like. And I kind of see myself as a bridge between, you know, the pharmaceutical manufacturing and giving the patient what they need and what they want on the ground. And then hopefully I can feed back directly onto the grow room and influence, you know, which cultivars go in and what we plan to extract and how we plan to use it and package it and label it and cost it.
It's quite a team that Rod has brought together. You referred to Rod as a powerful personality. He's a lovely guy.
Yes, yeah. But a force of nature. But
He is. He's just this really larger than life sort of character, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we're all of us, you know, are just doing this because we just love the industry. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, we're gonna get there. It's a really tough road bringing everything together, but we're all here just because we really love the industry, and we're all just very enthusiastic. And I think for all of us, you know, our hearts are in the right place, and we kind of want to do the right thing, make sure that the bulk of our medication stays here and is not exported, and our medications are a reasonable cost so that, you know, it's more accessible to more people.
That's really cool, and it's a really great way to round up. I just want to raise one little quirky thing Rod, as you mentioned, he's assembling this team, and you guys are all highly intelligent and highly credible workers that he's going to have on board. You're going to be very valuable to him. Now, one thing about you I want to talk about quickly before I wrap it up, and I can't have any more of your time. You mentioned to me last time we had breakfast together, I think.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you would rather read than watch a YouTube video or listen to a podcast because you can obtain the information quicker, and I want to know how. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I always thought that was true. I mean, I guess I just read really quickly.
Do you have like a tactic? Do you have like a skill?
Yeah, just move my eyes back and forth really quickly.
Because I've heard people talk about reading down the middle of the lines. And like subcategorizing and things you just read really quickly.
Yeah, and I guess I've just always just been reading voraciously my whole life.
So. I mean, to study medicine at Oxford, I would assume that you could read.
You learn to read quickly. Yeah, you do learn to read quickly because there's a lot to keep up with. But, you know, I've probably changed my mind about a lot of things since I last saw you, which was only, you know, how many months ago? 6-8 months ago.
Yeah, max.
You know, I think that, you know, using the podcasts to sort of allow you to kind of learn a bit more while you're commuting to work, or using time to that you wouldn't otherwise use for learning, or even just unwinding, I think, you know, it's really, really valuable. So yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. I use podcasts personally in that way. If I'm having a workout, I'll chuck on some podcast so that I can learn while I'm having a workout. If I'm mowing the lawn or something, I'll chuck on some headphones and I'll listen to podcasts. And I think it's a great tool, but still fascinating that you read that quick. And I love that. I love that about you, man. Hey, Steve, it's been really cool sitting down and chatting here at the head offices of Cantaponics, man.
Thanks for coming.
Like I said, it's really rare that I get to do this.
We should do it again.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And we will because we've got to get the rest of the team on board as well.
I'd love to introduce you to Rod and Damien, who's our COO, who's an absolute wealth of knowledge in the pharmaceutical space.
That's a jet that you've got right there.
Yeah, and we'd love to just fill you in on our story at Cantaponics because it's quite compelling.
That's really cool, man. I've really appreciated your time, Steve.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you very much. And until next time, man, peace out, guys, and hope you enjoyed the episode. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Cantar. Any guest views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and not necessarily those of the hosts. Cantar strongly suggests listeners research local, state, and federal laws and regulations before conducting any cannabis-related activity.